This is Other Plans. I'm your host, Abby Gerke. My guest today is Roaring Fork Valley local and retired war correspondent Lauren Jenkins. He's best known for his eyewitness reporting in conflict zones all over the world. We'll talk about what he learned in Vietnam, finding truth in journalism, the old Aspen, winning a Pulitzer Prize, and much more. You can find the full interview on kdnk.org. I hope you'll listen. Well, Lauren Jenkins, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
You're welcome.
Are you talking to me from your new home in Willits?
I am indeed.
Lauren, most people run when they see or hear danger, but you spent most of your career in conflict zones in the name of getting the truth and reporting this for the greater good. What drew you to journalism in the first place?
Well, it was a process of elimination. You know, I spent my late teens, early 20s as a ski bum in Aspen, and I had grown up abroad, so I was always interested in the world and how it worked in different cultures and societies. So when I ended my ski bumming days, I joined the Peace Corps and went to Africa to teach school for a couple of years. And when I got out of there, I went to graduate school studying political theory. My interest was always, obviously, international issues, how nations and cultures deal with each other. And I wasn't going to work for the American government. My parents had, and I, at that time, it was the early days of the civil rights movement and the early days of the Vietnam protest. I didn't want to be associated with government policies. I wasn't a banker, and I wasn't a businessman, and sort of process of elimination, I decided on being an international journalist.
And specifically this type of journalism in conflict zones, how did you end up there?
By accident. I guess when I started, I thought I would end up in a comfy job as a film critic or something, but I went abroad. I was working for Newsweek, and their correspondent in Beirut got sick, and they asked me if I would go and fill in for him, and I did. And, of course, that was a year from hell because everything was happening. Planes were being skyjacked. The Palestinians were fighting against the Jordanian king. There was Israel. I ended up taking on not only China and most of Asia, but also Vietnam and Cambodia, which were deep at war. You go to a place like that because it's history in the making, and that's what journalism is all about. It's finding out how it's being made. You know, eventually, by accident, you get a reputation of someone who does conflict reporting.
The Vietnam War changed journalism and produced a new generation of journalists. You were there, as you said. How would you say this, being a Vietnam journalist, makes you different than other reporters?
Well, I think that, you know, the basic rule of reporting is to find truth. And how do you find it? I think all of us who went to Vietnam, young reporters, a big story, America at war again, discovered that almost everybody you go to has a spin on what reality is. And truth is often hidden or lied about. You know, those of us who were in Vietnam, we were lied by everybody we interviewed pretty much. You know, our president was lying. The commander of the wars was lying. A lot of the military was lying. The Viet Cong was lying, and the North Vietnamese were lying. The job is to find between the lies there's spin. The job of the media is to try and dodge through all of those misinterpretations and find the grains of truth that lie behind them.
So when you get to a place like Vietnam or Beirut or even Aspen, how did you figure out what was going on? How did you know who you could trust, who the players were, how to be safe? How did you figure that out in dangerous environments?
You know, you start developing sources. You know, in Vietnam, our sources who are all over the place, other journalists, opposition figures in Vietnam, the government of Vietnam, our government, the CIA, when you could get to them, and what was their view, what were they getting, and were they honest in telling you that, which they weren't necessarily. And then just going to where events happened. I mean, Vietnam was classic that there was a daily briefing at the end of the day in Saigon, where the military got up and reported what they wanted you to know of what happened today. And there'd be, all of a sudden, they'd get up and say something like, oh, we just killed 70 Viet Cong in this village north of Saigon. Bad journalists went to their telex machines, that's how we used to file stories, and reported what the government said. Good reporters jumped in a jeep and drove to that village to find out what really happened. And when you went into often to such villages, you found that the people killed weren't necessarily Viet Cong or the so-called enemy, but were innocent civilians. Maybe they had been bombed by accident by a U.S. plane or something happened. And so you got as close to where an event happened, to interview the people that actually witnessed it rather than the people that were giving you their versions of it that was satisfying to their policy.
At the time that you were in Vietnam, there were no cell phones. A phone call to New York must have been pretty expensive, and you were really far away from your boss back home in your 20s. And Saigon seems like it was pretty exotic. Did you like it? What was it like? And have you been back to Saigon?
I hated it because I hated the war. The war was stupid and wrong and shouldn't have been going on. A lot of innocent young soldiers were being killed, families upturned. I didn't like it. This was an important job. It was, as a journalist, it was the story of the day every day, year after year. So there was the excitement of covering a major international story. But I never liked Vietnam at the time because of the war. It took me, 10, 15 years after the war to ever go back. And I fell in love with the place. And peacetime, it's a beautiful country. The people are great. The food is excellent. It's absolutely beautiful, great beaches. I loved the place in peace. It was just the war that I didn't love. And it took a long time for me to go back there. I was working for NPR later, and I ended up opening a bureau in Hanoi for NPR.
To be a war correspondent on the ground, witnessing these tragic and terrible events in person, you have to be a special type of person. Would you agree?
No, I'm not so sure. There were all sorts of people, in the profession. I think a lot of them were there for different reasons, or as I said, I ended up there by accident. I never wanted to go to Vietnam, and all of a sudden, without my agreeing to it, my bosses put Vietnam under my coverage directions. it's different types. I don't know what motivates you. I came out of an international background. A lot of them didn't. What was the difference? I'm not sure I know.
Lauren, you've won major awards, including a Pulitzer Prize for your reporting in conflict zones of one sort of another. There was an essay written in Esquire in 1984 entitled Why Men Love War by William Broyles. No. It discusses the thrill of operating successfully in war zones. Here's an excerpt that sort of might give you an idea. Like all lust, for as long as it lasts, it dominates everything else. Do you think that analogy can be made for conflict correspondence? Is there a thrill of operating successfully in difficult conditions?
Anyone who's thrilled by it is nuts. There's no thrill to going to war. It's a major historic moment in society. Nations and cultures have been fighting against each other since day one. But as a journalist, it's an important story. It can change history. It changes people. It changes demographics. It's vital, and you go because it's important. You want to cover the best be the best journalist there is and provide the best insights into what's going on. It's not about thrills. So there certainly are correspondents and people who like war or find it exciting. I never did. I mean, I did the job that needed to be done. Sometimes it was terrible and stressful. Other times it was, I don't know, you felt successful because you got the story. And the story is about educating the world about what's going on and how it functions.
And as a correspondent, you must have felt, like you said, like you were serving the greater good, doing serious work, getting the news.
No, absolutely. I mean, that was the, you know, the rewards of the job I was doing was successfully doing it and knowing that it was an important job to do and it was a benefit to societies to understand what was going on in their world.
And like you just mentioned, at times it was obviously stressful. Were you ever fearful?
Oh, yes.
How did you handle fear and doing your job?
Well, when you're in the middle of a situation where fear is dominant, you know, you're only thinking about survival and getting your job done and getting safely out of there. It's only later that the fear comes at you in a way.
Do you think, you said it took about 10 to 15 years for you to go back to Vietnam. Do you think in all of your time as a conflict correspondent that you experienced any sort of PTSD?
I think everyone who's been caught in the middle of a war has got PTSD in one form or another later. It changes your life, it changes your perspective, and it obviously changes your mental state in some form or another. The cases we hear are the extreme cases where people really are affected for life by it. But I think anybody who says they never got PTSD after being in a conflict situation where there's a lot of violence is not being totally honest about what they went through.
And how did you handle your form of PTSD? Were you able to speak to someone?
Well, it was just growing out of it. I mean, you know, all those images and experiences are still vivid in one's mind. I mean, I could go back and relive this day or that day that was particularly horrible because it's something you experience and it doesn't go away.
You're listening to Other Plans on KDNK. I'm your host, Abby Gerke, and my guest is former conflict correspondent and Valley local Lauren Jenkins. You've lived all over the world, but always called this place, Aspen and the Roaring Fork Valley, your home. What drew you to Aspen in the first place?
Oh, God. Beauty, funkiness of old Aspen, which was an extraordinary place when I first came here for a summer job. When I came here in my late teens, I looked around and my parents were still working for the government overseas, and we had no real home in America. And I just looked around and said, this will be home. I had spent 4 years in a French boarding school in Switzerland where I learned to ski. So when I landed here, the skiing was certainly an attraction. And just the town was real special. I mean, it's all gone away with its fame and fortune, but it was an extraordinary place where everybody knew each other. It was classless, fun. What else can I say?
You were working for the Washington Post, and then you came to be the editor and owner of the Aspen Times. That must have been an incredible switch from the Washington Post to the Aspen Times. How did that happen?
Well, when I was young and foolish and did a lot of mountain climbing here and around, one of my climbing companions in those days was Bill Dunaway, who owned the Aspen Times and had been Kent's Mountain Division in World War II and settled here and bought the paper. And over the years, when I became a journalist, coming and going, I would joke with them. I said, you know, Bill, sometime if you decide to retire, let me know. I could get interested in this. And when I left the Washington Post, I was originally going to write a book. And I came back here to write the book and barely got back here when Bill called me and said, did I want to buy the Aspen Times? He was going to retire. So I said, okay, let me try and get a group together and we'll buy it. And I sold the idea to partners that it was a good vehicle to fight the issues of this valley, which are really development and protection of the environment. And they clash all the time. And that was seemed interesting to me. And I got a group together that wanted to do that. So we did it. We bought the paper and transformed it at the time. It was sort of fun.
Do you still think, you said the issue at the time was development versus protection of the environment? That sounds a lot like it still is now.
Of course. It's always that. In the Mountain West, you know, at what point does people and development change a place? Aspen has changed. It's not the same funky town that I first fell in love with. Still great, but it's a different place entirely.
You ended up leaving the Aspen Times. How did that happen?
Oh, I broke up with my partners. There was never much of a discussion about it. I think they maybe thought we were a little too strong in our pro-environment approach and criticism of the development that was happening at all around.
You worked for the Washington Post with Katherine Graham, correct?
Yes.
And what was she like?
She was an extraordinary lady. Gutsy, a real Washingtonian. Classy, and, you know, she had made the Washington Post one of the top two newspapers in the country. So it was exciting to work for them. I mean, their only competition was really the New York Times, and that exists to today, and a lot of that was done under Katherine Graham's reign.
You've said that you think, in your experience reporting with all sorts of people, that women are better reporters. What do you mean by that?
No, I didn't say they were better reporters. They're great reporters of all genders and sexes. I said that, interestingly enough, when I ran the NPR International Operations, they were more women war correspondents than men. And I've never quite understood it, but that is certainly the case today. If you listen to radio, certainly, there are more women out there covering wars than men. And it was totally different than Vietnam. Vietnam was very much a man's job, although they were three, four, or five great women reporters. But the majority were all men. And today, I haven't done a poll on this, but I just know my own experience at NPR that when I was running that, people covering the Iraq War and other wars were often women, and they were very good. And it's just somehow they have come to the fore, or maybe the businesses themselves that were all pro-male have opened up and gotten much more inclusive. But it's no longer just a man's game.
I listened to a video of you, a panel discussion. You've said that the best thing to happen to journalism today is our President Trump. What do you mean?
Well, I didn't say it was the best thing to happen to journalism. What I said is it's certainly made journalism important again in a way that it hadn't been maybe for a couple of decades. You know, what do you do when you have someone who's maybe unstable running the country and the world? Trump is not a sane man. I'm not a shrink. I can't prove it one way or the other, but if you look at his behavior and what he's done, for 4 years, it's been atrocious, both for the nation, for democracy, and for the world. I think the press, the media, the good media. I mean, there's bad media and there's good media, but the good media, the important media, have risen to the occasion. There's been some extraordinary reporting that maybe is best reporting in America since the Nixon days of Watergate. And it's because the story has gotten so important and so big. And we have a president who's refusing to acknowledge that he lost. He definitely lost.
And it's been researched and reported that trust in media has declined from very high to now low in your lifetime. Is the loss of trust a consequence of journalists being more free with their opinions?
No, the loss of media, confidence in the media, has to do with a president and an administration that for 4 years has lived in a separate reality and is called stories that it doesn't like, and the reality it doesn't like that gets reported, fake news. And, you know, when you have the President of the United States challenging the First Amendment day in and day out, there are a lot of people who believe him.
With the news at your fingertips, do you think people are better or worse informed now?
That's a tough question. As I say, if you look at how the presidential vote went, 74 million Americans voted for Trump despite 4 years of really outrageous behavior. I think education, we have a great education system for some people, for the privileged, and most Americans don't get a great education. You know, Trump's support is proof of it. Education isn't equal around the country. So at root of our problems is this lack of a better education system that reaches everybody.
At the beginning of this interview, we talked about reporters going on the front lines as correspondents looking for truth. And now with the Trump administration and alternative facts, there's another form of what they call truth. But how do you know if something's true? How do you personally, as a reporter, know when something's true?
The job of reporting is finding truth, and it's often difficult. It's often distorted, or you get parts of truth, but that's the mission. There is only one truth. There's only one reality. Just saying things doesn't make them true, and the job of reporters is to go out and, as I say, the presidential election is pretty easy to tell. You know, you count the votes.
Do you miss being a war correspondent?
Not at all. I did my time. I did the time to do it, and wasn't something I was going to do all my life.
What's the most important thing that you have learned from your career in journalism?
And it's an important, honorable profession. That our society, our democracy, can't work without good journalism to inform the public and the voters about what's really going on in their world, our world.
And I have to ask about your Pulitzer Prize. How did you find out the news that you had won the Pulitzer Prize for your Washington Post reporting in 1983?
How did I learn? I was here.
In Aspen?
In Aspen. And Ben Bradley, the executive editor of the Washington Post, called me when the Pulitzer Prizes were announced and said, "You just won a Pulitzer Prize for your reporting for the Washington Post." Later, we had a ceremony in Washington, a dinner party at Kay Graham's.
Why do you think you won that Pulitzer Prize?
It wasn't for me to judge. I did my job reporting the invasion of Lebanon by the Israelis, and the aftermath of that invasion was a terrible massacre of Palestinian refugees by Christian militias that the Israelis had encouraged to go into a refugee camp. It was horrible. It's still an outrageous event. No one still knows how many people were killed, but it was somewhere between 500 to 1,000. You know, I wrote the story best of my ability and reported it and revealed, you know, who done it, who the Christian militias were, and who their commander was. Pulitzer Prizes are judged by the Pulitzer Prize Committee, which is experienced journalists who look at all the good journalism of that year and make their choices.
After all your work in conflict zones, did this prepare you for all that life throws you outside of the job?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, you know, you live your life and you do what you do. I've lived a rich life, ups and downs, because of the job, because of life, whatever. And I feel I accomplished a lot. I learned a lot. Hopefully I informed a lot. Hopefully I educated some people about the world they live in.
What's next for you, Lauren?
I'm back to writing. I'm actually working on a screenplay for a TV series that I'd like to get on air. It's about what we've just been talking to. It's about the search for truth in a world of deception and lies, and it's based on international events.
Interesting. Well, I'll look forward to seeing that. Well, Lauren, thank you so much. I feel honored to be able to talk with you, and thanks for your courageous work in the news.
Well, thank you, Abby.
Times are hard.